Dived and chicken fried. Black cat bone, rolling stone, crossroad moaned. Freight trained, aching heart pain, gree-gree dusted, done got busted. Bo-weeveled, woman-eveled. Mojo, dobro, crossroad, and mofo. Sharecropped and diddly-bop, rising sun and son of a gun. Voodooed, hoodooed, and hoodoo-ewed. Red light was my minded, and baby, why you so unkinded? Mississippi muttered and chicken shack flooded. Boogie-woogie, stratocasted, blasted, and outlasted. 61 highwayed, and I did it my way. Little Willie John and been here and gone. $1 million rift and Jimmy Clift. Cotton picked and Stevie nicked. The blues, man, the blues, the blues. That aching old heart disease and Joker and the heartbreak pack. If it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. Demon engine of rock, matrix of uber amped Aerosmith, and the soul sound of me. Steven Tyler, peripheral visionary of the tribe of Oh Yeah. Now the blues is, was, and always has been the bitch's brew of the tormented soul. The fifth gospel of grits and groan. It starts with the first moan when Adam and Eve did the nasty thing and got 86 from the Garden of Eden. Once upon a time, in the beginning was. That's the way it always starts off. Every story, gospel, history, chronicle, myth, legend, folk tale, or old wives' tale blues riff begins with woke up this morning. The blues is soiled with muddy water, funky with Storyville whorehouse sweat and jizz, smoky from juke joint canned heat, stained with 100-proof rot gut and cheap cologne. It's so potent because it's been in every low-down, get-down joint the world has ever seen. Everybody sucks on someone's tit, and ours was the bitch's brew of the blues. My first sexual musical epiphanies came through the radio. They were all entangled together. I can't remember how old I was when I first realized they were separate things, but are they? That's the question. I used to listen to the radio as if these sounds and voices were coming from outer space. DJs were magicians who talked to you through the air somehow and brought you these erotic sounds, songs about love, desire, jealousy, loss, and sex. Later on, I'd listen to 1010 Winds, which was a New York rock station back then, and hear all these great, crazy characters talking that buzzy DJ jive talk. When I moved to Boston with a band at the end of 1970, Boston had the greatest rock and roll stations of all time. And believe me, I heard them all. Radio at its finest. When Aerosmith was just starting out, I began dating a very sexy DJ at one of those stations. I'd never known an actual disc jockey before, but I knew they were famous people who could get you famous and thus get you laid. But until I met her, I didn't know you could do both on the air. Of course, me being in a band and trying to make it in Boston, what better thing than to be over there on the air making out with her while she was doing the dog and cat reports? That's when they announced the missing pups and pussies. She didn't have prime time spotted, so she had to do a lot of public service spots. The community center is having a dance. The local synagogue is throwing a picnic. It was hilarious, the things I did to that woman while we were on the air, just to see if I could rattle her cage, see if I could get her to stumble on her words. I never really did. It was funny, though. We did the most incredible things. I'd give her head while she was on the air, take off her panties, and have her sit on my lap and fuck her. And all this was on live radio. Such outrageous stuff, and we got away with it. Nobody knew, but let me tell you what. She got rave reviews. Not only were we getting very, very high, I was shoveling spoonfuls of coke under her nose, but we were really climbing under the covers, so to speak. All this while she's on the air disc jockeying, playing Led Zeppelin, Yardbirds, Animals, Guess Who, Montrose, Stones, tons of great shit. It was a graveyard shift, but regardless of what it was, big or small, we are still live on the air, and it makes you just want to test the water and see what you can get away with. I used to do shit like sing along with records. People didn't know that I was doing it. They must have thought she was playing some outtake or live track. I'd tell jokes, recite limericks, make up bizarre news items. God, that was heaven. I would be all over the place. Early Fleetwood Mac with Peter Green, Blodwyn Pig, Taj Mahal, The Fugs. In those days, DJs would play the whole side of an album. Nowadays, some of your best XM Sirius stations play deep tracks. We should all be proud that our music, what they were inventing back then, has lasted so long. Love, and the music of its time, is its own reward, isn't it? And having sex with a DJ while she's playing Whole Lotta Love was the ultimate consummation of my radio sex music fantasy. Joe Perry, Joey Kramer, we went to the same high school in Yonkers, Tom Hamilton, and I arrived in Boston and got an apartment at 1325 Commonwealth Avenue in the fall of 1970, entering the city like spies, ready to conquer the world overnight. It took a little bit longer than we thought it would. With any of the bands I'd been in, I'd always wished we could live together. I'd been dreaming of that since I was 12, and now we could. We could write together, go to bed at night with a lick we wrote that afternoon fresh on our minds. The Island of Lost Boys. Day one, I said to the guys, "This is so great that we're living together. I fucking love that." It started out blissfully, but soon turned into little skirmishes over chewing gum and toothpaste and petty psychological feuds. But that's what marriages are. And in the end, the band really worked, and I think somewhere deep inside, and quite hidden even from themselves, they really loved me for making them do that when we lived at 1325. Stealing the food and cooking. I would make breakfast. We'd learn those songs and really craft them, make them tight. In his book, Hit Hard, A Story of Hitting Rock Bottom at the Top, Joey told the world that the reason he has a facial tic is that I abused him just like his father did. I used to yell at him. I'd say, "Don't play it like that, play it like this." I know good things don't come without practice. If I was hard on him, it was because we had to get it right. But because I had decided not to be the drummer in the band, I gained a right in my mind to be able to live vicariously through Joey. I had a dream. So in the beginning, Joey was my interpreter, and we sat and played together. I took my drum set and said, "Joey, today's the day." And he'd go, "What, man?" And I'd go, "Well, you set up your drums, and I'll set up mine right in front of you, and we're going to play facing each other." He never understood. Later on, with Aerosmith Records, he always thought that if I did a snare hit with him, or if I played the hi-hat while he played the drums, people would notice that there was someone else playing the drums, and I'd say, "Listen to Greg Allman's I'm No Angel or the Grateful Dead stuff with two drummers. It's a sound. The Beatles sang in a room that had a voice, which means the room had an echo. They didn't have some ass-fuck engineer trying to get rid of it. They put it on the track like that. Once it's a hit, that echo is on there forever. A room has its own sound and music. You can buy a machine and tune it to ambience. When we were making Just Push Play, we recorded our empty room. If you record that hall noise and sing over it, it's like letting the hall embrace you. It has chairs and equipment and people. The room is another instrument. The room is in the band." So with Joey, we would play together, and in the beginning, what I'm getting at is there'd be this Cheshire grin on both our faces. He loved me, and I loved him. He couldn't believe the tricks I knew, and to this day, he can play what I could never play. But back then, in 71, it was all about, "Hey, show me that again." Hence, there was I, night after night, sitting near his drum riser going, "Do a drum fill here." Because he really didn't know on his own that after the second verse, right after the pre-chorus, going into a chorus, one needs something exciting. And what would that be, Mr. Drummer? A drum fill. A pre-chorus means, "Whoops, here it comes." A verse should be the storytelling, and the pre-chorus is the "whoops, here it comes." And then a drum fill to go into it to show that it's important, to mark its importance. End of the song, maybe a pre-chorus again, and a middle eight, recapitulation, a little tip of the hat, something you might have said in the beginning of the song, to remind everybody what it was about, and whammo, right into your chorus, and you're out. And during the chorus and the fade, come on, play the drums even more. These things I knew and learned and passed on to Joey. So he played, and for the last 35 years, I lived through him. I don't know how not to. You know what one of my favorite albums of all time is? Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life, mainly because of what drummer Raymond Pounds decided to do, which was, in essence, not live up to his last name. There are very few drum fills on that amazing record. You can be good just holding down the fort. on Zeppelin's Kashmir. Listen to that drum beat. Simple. Straight. It gives the song legs, like the linemen who protect the quarterback. Since I'm a drummer and a perfectionist, I rode Joey hard, admittedly. But in the process, I made him a better musician. Like when we're sound checking in Hawaii, I sat down at the drums and wrote the drum line for Walk This Way. You want the story now, or when we get to Toys in the Attic? Hey, I never said this was going to be a completely linear read. How could it be? But we're on drums, so what the fuck? One of the things I'm most proud of is Walk This Way, and it's very ego and all, but even after you read the press about Run DMC and Rick Rubin, I still think the song was a hit in and of itself. And the proof of the pudding, backdoor lover always hiding neath the covers, you can't sing that unless you're a drummer or have some major sense of rhythm. So we're at the HIC Arena in Honolulu doing a sound check, and Joe was playing a riff, and I went, whoa, stop. I ran over to the drums. Joey had not come out yet. He was backstage, and Joe and I started jamming on the Walk This Way riff because Joe's rhythm was fucking get it. I got on the drums and played that, and that's where the Walk This Way drum beat came from. Joey wasn't the best drummer in the world when I joined the band, and I was a drummer, and was my theory of how a real band rehearses that fused the band together, playing that line from Route 66 over and over and over again, and because I wrote the song Somebody. Eventually, Joey achieved his independence as a drummer. He always had a hard time playing the rhythm at the end of Train Kept a Rollin', but he worked on his independence. That's your ability to move all four of your limbs independently. And in the end, he's turned into the greatest drummer in rock and roll. He now has a right ankle that's like a bicep from playing the bass drum. Joey says I drove him crazy, gave him a nervous breakdown. When we were in rehab together at Steps in Malibu in 1996, the class confronted me. What's the big idea of bringing someone here who's an active addict? I said, what the fuck are you talking about? Your drummer. Your drummer's on cocaine. He's got that tick addicts get from snorting coke. Then I had to explain, but I had no idea I was the explanation. Okay, so we're all living and working together, and we're getting these early gigs. Sure, there's friction from time to time, but nobody in the band has doubts that we're going to make it. Everybody was totally committed. No band I was ever in had gone to that extent. Prior to moving to 1325, I would look at Tom and go, you're not leaving, right? Are you a quitter? We're doing this, right? Nowadays, there are fewer places for a young band to set up and play and suck. Dare to suck. We did. You can too. Joey Kramer's the one who brought that funk and shit to Aerosmith because he was playing in black bands and he thought he was all that. Of course, he had no idea what he was going to blossom into. He's so distinctive. Even his mistakes fly. And then there was my old buddy and gangmate Ray Tabano. He was there from the beginning. Not the greatest guitar player on the planet, but one hell of a crazy motherfucker. Crazy Raymond. And I wanted the sound of two guitars in this band, i.e. the Stones. After a year or so, Brad Whitford would replace Ray in 1971. Like a lot of bands, we lived in the same house, played, got drunk, went to drug school together, stole to eat. We had no money. We were starving to death back then. I was stealing food from the Stop and Shop, rechristened the Stop and Steal. I'd go to the store and get some ground beef and shove it down my jeans to throw in with the rice. I'd make that gravy train shit that I could pour over some bread with brown rice and carrots, and then the six of us ate. The psychological warfare began with milk, which is pretty funny because it was over spilt milk that the band broke up in 1979. I'd get the milk in the morning and put it in the refrigerator. Then I'd go to get a drink of milk, and what the fuck, there's just a drop of milk left. Well, at least we left you something, they'd say. And there it is. There's the psycholactological crux of the thing. And that's pretty much as humorous as I can get about our petty daily band frictions. I've gotten real mad, but I never actually hit anybody in the band. That nobody ever hit me is a testament to their forbearance. I probably drove everyone nuts. But if you don't bring this shit out into the light, it gets suppressed and festers. Bands try and avoid aggravation, but hell, it can actually inspire you to write better songs. One day at the very beginning of 1971, I wrote the basic track and lyrics for Moving Out on a waterbed with Joe Perry in our living room at 1325 Comm Ave. I leaped up and shouted, Guys, do you realize what we just did? Their enthusiasm was curbed. Yeah, what is it, man? It's our firstborn, I proclaimed. The first Aerosmith song. How great is that? We all live on the edge of town. Where we all live ain't a soul around. People started coming, all we do is just a grin. Said we gotta move out cause the city's moving in. All this time, the band is sprawled out at 1325 Com, watching Three Stooges, drinking Ripple and Boone's Farm, smoking Mexican pot, which I hated. Pot makes you dumb as a bag of hammers, but enhanced the Stooges experience tenfold. They wouldn't have been interested if I'd said it was the end of the world. Move over, you're blocking the TV, they'd whine. No, man, I said. Let's go write some more songs. Bah, get the fuck out of here, and they flicked their joints at me. I got really fucking pissed off at these guys, went into the other room, sat down at the piano, and wrote another verse to Moving Out. Finished up Make It, Don't Break It, and worked on Dream On. And just did a shitload of stuff. Love may be the best driving wheel, but anger is a pretty good second. The albums that had a huge effect on me were Taj Mahal and Deep Purple. A mixture of Taj Mahal and the Yardbirds. That's what I brought to Aerosmith. I said, these albums are going to be our Bible. Let's have at it. Taj Mahal. God, his album was so instrumental for me, leaving all those cover bands and doing Aerosmith. I named my son for Taj. It was Taj Mahal singing Going Up to the Country, Paint My Mailbox Blue. Right out in the open with his harmonica. That first album, I still listen to it. We got Train Kept a Rollin' from the Yardbirds. But it started as an R&B hit for Tiny Bradshaw, who was a swing band leader. Johnny Burnett hillbillyized it in the 50s, and the Yardbirds just smoked it. What did we have to lose? I always wanted to do Roadrunner, my totem critter. Bo Diddley's version, Brit Bluesicized by the Pretty Things. The first thing you gotta do is get yourself a blues Bible. Yardbirds, Led Zepp, Stones. The old uber-amped Brit Blues shit. Pieces of the True Cross, baby. Fiery holy relics. Peter Green playing on Oh Well or Rattlesnake Shake on Fleetwood Mac's Live at the BBC. What the fuck? Hidden truths. Melodic sensibilities are embedded in that vinyl. Now, any idiot can basically buy that kit. A bald-headed accountant in a fright wig and tight spandex can do it and end up on the cover of a heavy metal mag. But in the days and confused days of yore, the mystic moves of Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, and Peter Green were only revealed to true believers. When Jimmy Page came to Boston on the Outrider tour in June of 1988 and dedicated Train Kept a Rollin' to Stephen and Joe from Aerosmith, that was like a blessing from one of our gods. We rehearsed at Boston University, down in the basement of the girls' dorm. Jeff Green, the director of the West Campus One Dorms, was a heavyset guy who loved the band and let us practice there for free. We rehearsed until 4:30 and then hitched a ride back to the apartment so we could all watch the Three Stooges at 5 on Channel 38, sharing a bong full of brown Mexican marijuana. Let's get stupid and smoke some pot. Well, not everybody gets stupid. I actually think I wrote some good lyrics on pot, but meth, coke, and two-and-alls were my drugs of choice. In Joe Perry, I'd seen raw power, but how to harness it. One day, it dawned on me why Led Zeppelin was the shit. Jimmy Page figured it out, and it wasn't jamming. Everyone in that band knew what they were playing and played the same rhythm. I heard Joe Perry, Tom Hamilton, and Pudge Scott jamming back at the barn in Sunapee. I was blown away by their unleashed fury, but I wasn't crazy about their rambling, indulgent noodling. Hey, we're jamming, man, they'd say. They even called themselves the Jam Band. My answer to that was, yeah, and what? What? There's nothing so great about three people jamming. It's all egotistical, all over the place. So I said, how about instead of each of you going off on your own tangents, you all play in sync? Now there's balls. You guys, we gotta play together. We can't jam and be a big fucking rock band. The foot's gotta play with the bass. Then we'll have a serious fucking rock machine. There are secrets to rock, just as there are secrets about making love to your wife or girlfriend. Do you come at the same time? I'm not going to ask, but I will tell you that some of the finer moments in my life were making love to a woman and coming together. There's an ancient magic ritual to this. If right before both of you come, you make a pact or say a prayer and focus that thought, sweet Jesus, I want you to send this light to cure an illness, to achieve some deep purpose in your life. It will happen because there is no power on earth stronger than that. There's electromagnetic theory behind it. If I hooked up that energy at the instant you came to an electrode, it would go... The little red needle would thrash like a rattlesnake's tail. Now, what if you had a thought while your electricity was ramped up? What if your every thought had an electrical charge attached to it that got over-ramped during sex? When the two orgasms combine, they have unbelievable psychic power. The English occultist Aleister Crowley based his ritual magic on this principle, and it's an interesting fact that for a dozen years in the 70s and 80s, Jimmy Page owned Bolskeen House, Crowley's old home on the shore of Loch Ness, so who knows what effect Crowley's magic had on the serpentine rise of Led Zeppelin. I practiced that Crowley magic, so I know it works. I'm not saying that every girl I slept with came at the same time as I did, or that I asked her to pray for the same thing I was praying for. Namely, that Aerosmith would become the greatest American band, but then I didn't have to, because that's all I ever thought about, or prayed for. Every kid on every block in every city in America wants to be a rock star, but if girls, money, fast cars, houses in Maui, and skybox seats to Red Sox games are your only motivation, and that's a lot of motivation, then you're in trouble. Aerosmith has been together, the five of us, for 40 years. With a short 2-year break. And you don't get to do that without some very strong motivating force to counterbalance all the stupid fucked up things that are constantly working to tear you apart. The psychic glue that held us together was the music. The collective sound that the five of us make. Peel back the layers of the onion. That's what it is. And when it works, it's above and beyond your wildest dreams. Like it must have been for Jimi Hendrix's band. His music was so heavy that when you hear the thunderous, orgasmic opening to Purple Haze, you don't have to say anything. You can imagine Jimmy's drummer, Mitch Mitchell, listening to that playback and going, "Oh my God, oh my God." The rush and din of it sucked you in. It pulled you under. It was magnetic, utterly addictive. You would follow that sound to the ends of the earth. It's not something you can walk away from. It's the sound of humping, pumping, grinding life itself with a voodoo vibe to it. I remember my first girlfriend, Geraldine Rapetti, saying, "I heard this song on the radio. I've never heard music that sexy." "What do you mean?" She goes, "Purple Haze." Jerry Rapetti had the biggest boobs. I couldn't even look at them when I was standing in front of her. They were so big. It so affected me. I was stuttering, because she was so beautiful. She said, "Steven, you gotta hear this record. This is the sexiest music I ever heard." And just hearing her say, "sexiest music," I could feel the lump already rising in my pants. "Sexy? What do you mean by that?" She played me, "Are You Experienced?" And come on. She was so fucking right on, because when you heard those Stratocasting gears churning, that was sex as sound in its purest primal form. No one had ever played like that, no one. So imagine being in his band and saying, "We just played that." Or the Stones creating that raunchy, spooky blues vibe, that energy, that tangible force that could not be denied. It had to be reckoned with. A sound that would be the mouthpiece for a whole generation. When you think about rock bands that made it, why did they make it? How did they make it? What did they make it for? I can get really emotional about this stuff because the music that they made was so strong, so overwhelming, it was a prayer and an answer all at once. The Beatles, come on, what the fuck? It wasn't because they were all such great musicians. They knew. They knew. They were English, and they had long hair when nobody else did, and they said funny things, but it wasn't that either. It was the alchemy they cooked up. Everly Brothers, Buddy Holly, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, and music hall numbers. And they evolved, as did the Stones, the Who. Many groups came out, had a hit, and then took the ferry back across the Mersey. The Beatles went from She Loves You to Help within a year. In 1 year. Not 10. In 2 years, they were at the trippy Rubber Soul. Norwegian Wood. How great is that? So you can say what you want, but in 1 year, they started out recording in a room where Paul and John sang together on one mic, took that vocal and dumped it down to one track, and added it to the next vocals. You know what that means? It means you can't go back. They had to be so sure of themselves. Plus, of course, they had George Martin as a producer. We needed a name, so we all got together and tossed names around the table, like Stitt Jane. I came up with the Hookers. No one liked that. How about Aerosmith, Joey suggested. Aerosmith? You mean like the Sinclair and Lewis novel we had to read in high school? And then a minute later I went, Aero, A-E-R-O, right? And he goes, yeah. Now that was cool. The name evoked space, aerodynamics, supersonic thrust, Mach 2, the sound barrier. I thought if we could stay together, that name would always work because we had nothing to look forward to except the future. I always imagined that when I was 50, there'd be robots already, skateboards that floated and you could jump on. Everything that happened to me since I was 10 came out of comic books anyway. All the superheroes had that shit, every bit of it, lasers, lightsabers, phones that you could talk into. Dick Tracy had that watch on his arm. He was talking to it all the time. Watching Dick Tracy, I used to think, what if we all had one of those watches? But it was just a crazy kid thought. Now everyone has one with all the apps. Check your email, blog, Twitter me, and please sit on my Facebook. I'd thought of calling us the Hookers because I considered playing clubs a form of prostitution. I'd spent 6 years playing clubs in New York and knew how exhausting and frustrating it was. So with Aerosmith, we avoided the club scene like the plague. It's a trap. The money's okay, $1,000 a week would be a nice payday, but doing 4 sets a night, for 45 minutes each, even if the club was empty, for a 2-week stretch playing other people's material will grind you down. No time to rehearse, write, develop new material. People shouting, play Maggie May! Hey, you fucks, know any Creedence songs? In any case, we were too rowdy for most clubs and bars. We got kicked out of Bun Ratty's bar in Boston because we started to incorporate original material, and the club owners didn't like that. Instead, we focused on colleges, high school dances, ski lodges. We played around a lot, mostly weekends, rehearsing during the week, playing high school dances out in the country, getting maybe $300 a night. We played absolutely anywhere that 50 people would come see us. As the keeper of our gig calendar, I had to make sure we had at least 3 dates a month for around $300 to cover our rent and basic nut. We functioned like a guerrilla band. Play a small town, establish a beachhead, develop a small fan base. Next time through, there'd be more kids and more enthusiastic fans. Our set list was our Brit Blues catechism. Real heavy metal to me is Led Zeppelin playing Dazed and Confused. We got our roots the same place Zeppelin got theirs, and I don't mean from Jake Holmes, the guy who inspired Jimmy Page. I mean, the blues. When we started out, there must have been 5,000 rock and roll bands in the Boston area alone trying to make it. But if you are going to separate yourself from the pack, you have to develop your own identity, and you aren't going to do that by playing other people's songs. In the very beginning, we too did cover versions. We only had a couple of our own songs. We never played in our street clothes. We always dressed up, put on a show. You're in a band, lads. We've got to get flash. The look is the hook. I got the band to strut their stuff, dress up, get their sartorial swagger on. I'd walk into Caprice, an antique store on Newberry Street owned by my friend Barbara Brown. She said to come down to her store and she'd give us some clothes for our first album photo shoot. I had to ease the guys into the fashion thing. I was already having my leather pants done in flames from the girl who lived upstairs at number 5 Kent Street. I brought the band to Caprice and told them to rummage around, pick their own stuff out. It was a free-for-all. The store was opposite Intermedia Sound, where we would record our first album. Here, put this on, I said. Hell no, I'm not going to wear that. Ah, come on, man. Just do it for the pictures. Look at the Brit Art School flash. Look at Jimmy Page. Look at Mick. Look at Jimi Hendrix, Jeff Beck. Look at Pete Townsend. The Union Jack jacket is the shit. Are they wearing jeans and army surplus? I don't think so. After a lot of yakking, they got into the clothes that made the picture on the first LP cover explode, and they looked fucking great. That photo was taken on the stoop in front of Barbara's store. Brad had one of her shirts on, Joey's got her jacket, I wore the hat and the belt. That's it, baby. We got the shot, and then some brain-dead police working at Columbia shrank it down and put clouds behind it. The beginning of my corporate hell. We raided the closets of the hip-wazee, Brit dandies, hippie tatterdemalion, a mad mix of Kings Road medieval motley, pimp swagger, Stones gypsy gear, and Carnaby Street kitsch. Janice's Haight Ashbury scarf-draped bordello exotica. God, I'm getting off just saying this. And a touch of titillating androgyny for shits and wiggles. Anything startling, garish, glam, and over the top. Jewelry, earrings, black lace, feathers, metal flake, eyeliner. All the stuff we need to look cool and out there, whatever it takes to spark that outlandish rock star impudence. Anything that denotes snotty, defiant arrogance and beyond the pale chic. Let your freak flag fly, and a few Aerosmith tattoos just to underline the outlaw element. Find out where they are, folks. We were perfect for the dandified Brit look. We weren't pumped. On the contrary, we were skinny and weedy, just like the English musicians. Anyway, our outfits paled beside those of the New York Dolls. Hot pants, fake leopard skin, black nail polish, pantyhose, bouffant hairdos, feather boas, and 6-inch platforms. Most of this band's early career had been spent making fun of me for what I wore, clothes and shoes, and then they'd wind up wearing it themselves. I'd put jewelry on the guys in the band, and there would be a comment. Joe has said to me more than once about my style or what I was wearing, "Wow, I love those pants. Do they make them for guys?" At first, and for a very long time thereafter, Joe was aloof. When I'd point out that this is the stuff Mick Keith and Jimmy Page wore, he'd say, "What do I want to look like him for? I'm me." I just wanted to be a gypsy. Interestingly enough, whatever Joe's own thing is, your thing, anyone's thing, that's it. That's where the song, Make It, came from. You know that history just repeats itself. What you just done, so has somebody else. You know you do, you gotta think the past. You got to think of what it's gonna take to make it last. I lifted those lyrics out of the creative ether, my inner voice. I live and stand by it. You've got to make up your own shit out of what's already there. I always figured, I don't know what I'm doing, but I know I'm doing it. I kind of got offended when Madonna came out with her thrift shop chic like she'd invented it. That's the way everyone dressed from 1966 to Woodstock. And then in the 80s, Madonna came out with Material Girl and her bangles and stuff, and I went, yes! Wow, what a fickle fucking mass media. Because nowadays, everything's recycled. There's nothing new. Everything's in quotation marks. What wasn't before? Gypsy Boots, he was the first nature boy, living in a tree and dressing like it's 1969. My dream had come true, but the second I said, "It's so great that we're all living together," Joey moved in with his girlfriend, Nina Lausch, and Joe moved out with Alyssa. Was it my breath? We were a unit, watching the sparks fly day or night. Didn't they know that some of the best creative shit came in the midnight hour? In my other bands, I'd seen how women led to a breakup. Look at the Beatles, and I didn't want that to happen to us. I pleaded with my brother, "Joe! You're Joe fucking Perry. You're the ultimate, the beyond which there is nothing. When I met you, I knew I'd found my guy. Come on now, man. You gotta stay. We gotta write together. That's the whole reason I moved to Boston." But to no avail. I was angry at Alyssa because she stole my boyfriend, my significant other, my partner in crime. It was like losing a brother. So now there was jealousy, this dark undercurrent humming along. I felt that Joe abandoned me, that he cared more about Alyssa than he did about the band. After all these years, it's okay to admit it. I was really hurt that he would rather be with Alyssa than be with me, especially after we started writing songs together. Like I said earlier with moving out, Joe's sitting on the waterbed and I hear him strumming this thing and I go, "Hold on, whoa, what's that?" And a minute later, Joe's riffing and I'm scribbling, "We all live on the edge of town. Where we all live, there ain't a soul around." And it was in the afternoon, and that song wouldn't have happened unless we'd been living together. Writing songs was fucking. I took my anger and jealousy and eventually put it into sweet emotion, which I pointed at Alyssa directly. You talk about things that nobody cares. You're wearing out things that nobody wears. Calling my name, but I gotta make clear. I can't tell you, honey, where I'll be in a year. I used my jealousy and anger for lyrical inspiration. Looking back, I'm actually grateful that Joe moved out with Alyssa. It gave me something to sing about, a bittersweet emotion. My relationship with Joe is fraught, to say the least. Even in the best of times, we sometimes don't speak for months. On tour, we're brothers, soulmates, but there's always an underlying tension broken up by moments of ecstasy and periods of pure rage. Mutual animosity is a necessary part of a band's chemistry. It's all egos in a band anyway. Would you want to be in a group who were all clones of yourself? Pretty much anyone who wants to be a rock star is by definition a raging narcissist. Then just add drugs. It may be one for all and all for one, but each one of us is an egomaniac. We're all in it for gain and glory and showing the world how fucking great we are. It's me! And when you have five me's, they say, as long as you can keep that competition healthy, it's all good, dog. But just try to be that reasonable when you're 18 or even 26. The only way this actually works in a positive way is also out of ego. When, say, Joe or Brad comes up with a riff and I think, fuck, that's great, and I want to try and top it by reversing the melody or writing a lyric that will blow everybody away. Joe and I are opposites in many ways, and that's what fueled our creativity. So I knew if we were going to run like that, it would inevitably cause a lot of tension. The friction between us started almost immediately. When Aerosmith played their first gig at Boston's Nipmuc Regional High School on November 6, 1970. We'd barely gotten through the first number when I began shouting at him, "Turn your fucking amp the fuck down. You don't need to be so fucking loud." I couldn't hear myself singing. I can't sing in the key of the band if I can't hear my voice. I need to hear my voice over the music to know if I'm in tune. Truth is, the energy was so there with the band it didn't matter whether I heard myself or not. That was a private inside joke between me, myself, and I. I came from the club days before monitors and held my finger in my ear so I could hear myself. Like my dad says, if you have bad ears, I sound pretty good. I've had constant blow-ups with Joe about how loud his amp is. Remember in Spinal Tap when Nigel Tufnel shows the rockumentary director the 11 setting on his amp? Well, my guitar player definitely had his amp turned up to 12. I tuned Joe's guitar for him way back then because his ears were already damaged by the volume of his guitar. They're still shot. Joe's had tinnitus for years. What he hears most of the time is a high-pitched whine. You want opposites in a band. That's what makes the big wheel turn and the sparks fly. But when you have such widely differing personalities, there are going to be some upsetting exchanges. Joey told me about the time we were on Newberry Street at Intermedia Studio. Joey was on one side of the street, and Joe was walking on the other side. Joey crossed the street to be next to Joe and said, "Hey, Joe, how you doing? Can I walk with you?" He was so full of that wow and wonder of recording our first album and just playing being Joey Kramer, who happens to have the biggest heart in the band. And Joe says, "Yeah, sure." Pause. "So, Joe," Joey asks him, "why can't we be friends?" And Joe doesn't even pause before he fires back, "Why? Just because we're in a band, we gotta be friends?" Which was pretty harsh. Now, Joe may say today, "Well, I was just fucking with him." Really? Well, there was a lot of wounded silence hanging there as Joey walked away. He never forgot it. In a group, it's always about who the fuck you think I am, because it's all mental, it's all attitude. If you're scared of the dark, then the devil's going to come out of that blackness. If you're afraid of the ocean, you're going to feel like something bit you on the toe. That isn't to say that if you're not afraid of the ocean, you won't get eaten by a shark. At the beginning of December 1971, we got booked into the Academy of Music on 14th Street in New York, third on the bill with Humble Pie and Edgar Winter's band. We packed all our gear in a bus and headed down there. We had no bass amps. We borrowed some to get on that stage and play. Steve Paul was the promoter. He managed the Winter Brothers, the two albino blues musicians from Texas, Johnny and Edgar. Johnny had just got out of rehab that night, but at that time, Edgar was the bigger Winter. The Academy of Music was the biggest gig we'd had, where I'd seen the Stones some years before. Right before the Stones came on stage, I could see Keith's boots and the high heels, and I knew it was them, and I just about fucking wet my pants. I was freaking. The audience was screaming, the lights were down, but you could see those boots. Then, years later, I'm sitting with Keith shortly after his father died at Dick Friedman's house. He owns the Charles Hotel in Martha's Vineyard. And we're smoking cigars, discussing life and shit. Talk about surreal. I felt my mind going back to that very Stones show and the image of those boots. Anyway, I'm backstage at the Academy going, oh my God. On top of which Steve Paul was considering managing us. I knew Steve from his club, The Scene, on 46th Street. I played at The Scene with the McCoys, Rick Derringer's band. Derringer was backstage at the Academy of Music tuning his own guitar by doing a method called octaves. You hit an E, octave up, and you get a harmonic, and when it stops waving, then you're in tune. I called the guys over. Joe, Brad, you gotta see this. It's a way of tuning without me using the harmonica. I'd spent the last 2 years tuning the guys on stage with an E harmonica in my mouth. I would tune Joe's E string, and they'd try and take it from there. Now the guys could tune their own guitars. Bloody hell. Genius. I saw Derringer play live at Klein's department store in Yonkers in like 67 or 68 doing Hang On Sloopy. He had to have been 16 years old. I was dazzled to death. That night, we were an opening act. We were meant to play 3 songs and get off. We did all originals. Make It, One Way Street, and Major Barbara. For whatever reason, on Major Barbara, Joe and I decided to sit down and play. We weren't really sure of anything except making an impression and getting our songs right. The audience started chanting, "We want Edgar." So I butted the songs up so close together, that way the crowd didn't have time to heckle us. We shouldered on and jammed. If we stopped playing for 20 seconds, we'd get a loud boo from the crowd. It didn't feel good. Major Barbara, a song we've never released, had gone over quite well. No boos, just a couple of shouts. Under that kind of pressure, you don't know what you're doing. You just go with whatever you have and try not to give a shit, which we did. So we just launched into Walking the Dog. We could see Steve Paul in the wings getting apoplectic. Get them off. But we continued on and finished our set. As we got off the stage, Steve Paul pulled me to the side of the stage and gave me a lobeful. Don't you ever sit down at a show that I book. Years later, I was out at Steve Paul's house with my first wife, Serenda. I have to tell you something, Steven, he said. If it hadn't been for that stupid stunt where you and Joe sat down on the stage during Major Barbara, I'd have become your manager. Joke's on you, Steve. Looking back, it was a ballsy thing to do, sitting down. Nowadays, you call that an acoustic set, unplugged. We just sat down so Joe could play slide on his guitar. It was very ahead of its time. And Joe played a great slide. The apartment at 1325 was on the second floor, so when we came back from a gig, we'd hump all our shit up the stairs. One night, as we were unloading, I spotted a small suitcase lying against a telephone pole. I looked around, no one was there, so I snuck it upstairs real quick. Inside was a lot of dirty laundry, an ounce of pot, and $1,800. Wow! I grabbed the pot and the cash and took the suitcase back down and put it back in the spot where I found it. No one will ever think I took it, I told myself. There was no one else around, but obviously someone was going to come looking for this stuff, and they weren't going to think it was the little old lady on the 5th floor who took it. Had to be the guys in Aerosmith unloading their van. I took the cash, bought an RMI, Rocky Mountain Instruments keyboard, and took it out on the road. I worked up Dream On it and played it at our next gig. You know, the Shabu Inn or whatever it was, the Fish Kettle Inn or the Fish Kitten Inn. Eventually, 2 thuggish guys showed up and demanded the suitcase, the money, and the pot. They had guns. Fuck. What now? Out of the basement comes our biker super and first security guy, Gary Kabazi, who was something of a maniac, not to mention huge, toothless, bald, 350 pounds of fucking flaming, angry, Italian, quivering flesh, who would be delighted to kick the shit out of anyone who came near the band for whatever reason, waving a Civil War saber. I've already called the cops, he says to the thugs, so get out of here. The cops will be here any minute. and the guys put their guns down and ran, never to be seen again. We were going to follow our quest to the bitter end, but by December of 1971, we were pretty much at the end of our tether and of everything else, too. No money, no food, no gigs, nowhere to rehearse, and $19 in the bank. I'm always one for taking things to the wall, but occasionally you actually hit the wall. We were at a dead end, our last gasp, and then we got an eviction notice. And just at that moment, an angel appeared unto us in the form of a well-connected Irish promoter named Frank Connolly. Through a guy who played in a local band, we heard about a rehearsal space at Fenway Theater on Massachusetts Avenue. John O'Toole was the manager there and gave us our first big break when the hard rock group Cactus canceled because of a snowstorm and we filled in for them. John O'Toole put us in touch with Frank Connolly, who had brought the Beatles, Hendrix, and Led Zeppelin to Boston. Frank was connected to the movers and shakers of Boston, and he believed in us in an epic way, in the same way we believed in ourselves. To wit, that as unlikely as it seemed at the time, we would become the greatest rock and roll band in the world. And as future superstars, he gave us a salary, $100 a week each. Frank wanted us to do it all over again. At first, I was a little pissed off because I'd spent the last 5 years playing every club in New York and Long Island, but Frank knew that this new band was going somewhere, so he got us to play this new club in Massachusetts for a month to hone our chops and build a buzz. Father Frank was a brilliant promoter and a visionary. He understood us, but he didn't have the connections we needed to get a record contract, so he became partners with two guys from New York, David Krebs and Steve Lieber, who knew the record business. They managed the New York Dolls, the hippest, most outrageous band around, so we were thrilled, initially anyway. They would arrange for us to perform at a showcase for the major record companies at Max's Kansas City. They also helped us out of a few jams. Frank died from cancer some years later, and the voices inside me said he knew something was going on, so he passed us over to Lieber and Krebs. Probably through some other world connection of Father Frank's, we occasionally played seedy joints like Scarborough Fair, a Boston bar where you could get shot for saying the wrong thing to the wrong person. One New Year's Eve, we were playing a gig there. The place was packed with bikers and local thugs. A great hairy biker chick came up to us and gave the band a nasty arm's length, "Fuck you." "Hey," I said, "I can see your string hanging." A gasp went up from the crowd in the bar, and right then I knew we were in serious fucking trouble. She was the girlfriend of the president of the Trampers, a gang of bikers that were too lame to make it into the Hells Angels. A menstrual cycle gang, I called them. The guys in the crew told us that I'd insulted the biker babe's honor, and the Trampers were lined up outside and were going to stomp us all to death. I am, I admit, a foul-mouthed individual. None other than Chuck Berry dubbed us full of soul and full of filth. I was forced to make a groveling apology to the girl. Then we called the cops and got the hell out of there. We started out doing tours of clubs and colleges around the Northeast in an Olds Delta 88, amply fortified with drugs, which makes the highway a little hairy. It was just around the beginning of Aerosmith's 71-72, playing a gig in some godforsaken place. We were on the New Jersey Turnpike, and the fucking cops pulled us over. They found some pot in someone's bag in the trunk. I had put a bag of pot down my pants. Brad had 2 ounces of pot stuffed in his right pocket. Tom had a couple of roaches in a film canister. And my hash coffin, that infamous tiny metal box, had some hash dust and a Nembutal in it. The cops saw us throw the pot out the window of the car. So, off to the police station. We were handcuffed to this bar that ran along a wall that looked like a dance bar. I still have the pot down my pants and am handcuffed to Joe, but I had one free hand. When the cops went to go book us, they said, "You know, that's the Aerosmith guy." "Oh, really?" came the echo. We were kind of known, but not that well known. They left us in the hallway, and as soon as there was a moment where no one was around, I took the pot out really quick and threw it across the room. We wound up in booking. They let us go one at a time. "What's your name? Stand there. Your weight?" As they were taking a picture, I looked up, and right on his desk is where the bag of pot had landed. The cop never saw it. I thought, that is it. I went, "Hey, you guys, look." And they went, "Shut up." All nervous and shit. That's my band. Beavis and Butthead would have gone, hey, that's so fucking cool. But my band was, shut up, you're gonna get us busted. I think Joey had it down his pants. By some miracle, misplaced evidence, and help from our managers, Lieber Krebs, who got us the heavy-hitting lawyers, we were all slapped with misdemeanors and then released. Back on the road to ruin. Early tours were very simple affairs. We had the two Joes, limousine drivers from Buffalo who drove us around the Midwest, plus a station wagon for the bags. Both drivers were Italian and pretty dumb, but one of them was way dumber. Joe the Dumber won the Golden Sow Award for pulling this girl backstage in Terre Haute. She had a little sailor outfit on, white pleated skirt, and the whole bit, a big healthy corn-fed state fair girl. One of the best things the band did early on was to use that billboard in Copley Square. Raymond came up with the idea. The billboard had had nothing on it for a while, so we worked out a deal with them to put the Aerosmith wings up. This was after we got the wings redesigned. The first Aerosmith backdrop cloth had the A logo with wings on it, but they looked like bat wings, little stubby things. The deal with the billboard company was that we could put our logo up, and then when somebody wanted to come and rent it, fine, they could just cover it over. It was up there for a long time. Anybody that came in or out of Boston saw those wings before they even knew who we were. That was 72, 73. It was above New England Music City. Fenway Park is right there. You go over that little footbridge and you're in the park. Those were the days. New England Music City was a record store. It was about the size of probably the bathroom of a hotel suite. A tiny little corner store. It's probably a Cumberland Farms franchise or a Store 24 now. But that was where you'd go and flip through the records back in the day. You could read all about the bands on the back of the album. After 1325 Com Ave, we rented a house at 39 Kent Street in Boston with all these sailors. Back then, we were lowlifes who didn't live anywhere and were just barely getting by. We made our first tapes at my friend Rick Smith's house. He's now a manager. Rick had a rich college friend who had tape recorders, so we got a chance to record things like Walking the Dog and shit like that before we made our first album. And that's where we began to start thinking seriously about making a record and saw that we could. They had a room that was all lined with cork so you could laugh and sing and play late at night and no one would hear you. At that time, I was hanging out with Buddy Miles. He had this giant silver skull full of cocaine. The night I met the skull, David Hull and Charlie Farron, Buddy's guitar and bass player, joined us in the living room where the drummer told all these wild tales. Buddy had been in a lot of famous bands. He'd played with Duke Ellington, Charlie Parker, Wilson Pickett, Mike Bloomfield's Electric Flag, and had been the drummer in Jimi Hendrix's last group, Band of Gypsies. I asked Buddy questions about what it was like to go on tour. Where do you stay? What do you do? The girls, do they come to your room? Oh, you go down to the bar and find them there. Oh, yeah. I had never actually gone on tour yet. What we did in the early days was do one-offs. He told us what it was like to be on the road, the perks, so to speak, and I was flabbergasted. It was my first taste of what I wanted. In my room on Kent Street, I created my psychedelic cave. I went to the Army and Navy store and bought a parachute, a big fucker. It would drape an entire ceiling. Then, in the middle where there was a hole, I tacked it up around the light and draped the sides. The parachute was white, so I took four boxes of red dye, put it in the washing machine on hot, and when it came out, it was a nice blood red. Then I strung Christmas lights, tacked them up along the sides so my room resembled a big tent. I'd open the door and pull the parachute silk up and over. When you went in there, it was like being in the womb. It was like a red cave, a safe place. And the Christmas lights behind the parachute were on and blinking and you felt, I'd pull the plug for the lights out and go to sleep. I lived in black orchid oil, that intoxicating aroma. It's now illegal to make it because of how many orchids they have to smush to make the oil. At first, I got the orchids from a friend, and then in the 70s, I began to grow orchids myself. It has to be really hot and steamy for orchids to thrive, so I always had two vaporizers going in my room. Oh, it was Sticky Sweet and She's My Girl. Everything was wet and dense like the Amazon, the Mato Grosso. That room inspired my singing and writing because when I went in there, nothing else existed. I guess normal people can do that without creating an Amazonian rainforest in their bedroom. They can go to the library and write their essays and stories, bury their face in a book. They're so into it. But I was pretty much so ADD that I had to live in a psychedelic cocoon. Not that I minded distractions from appliances. If the TV was on when I was studying, I loved it. And all the kids today, every one of them can study with the TV. I look at my daughters, Mia and Chelsea, and they can cram for finals to Pharrell while applying nail polish at the same time. Holy multitasking, Batman. But that orchid oil-drenched parachute cave was for me a really safe, warm womb to work in. A sanctuary so hot and humid, seeds would sprout in there, spontaneously evoking the demons I danced with to write my lyrics. 1972 was a much better year for us. We played Max's Kansas City, the legendary New York club, three times that year. I spent the hour before the gig looking out the window thinking, my God, what are all those limousines doing out there? And then a mad thought came to me. Oh my God, John Lennon's here. But of course he wasn't. It was a paper house, which means it was all corporate, all executives. People in the business coming to see us. I didn't know that David Krebs had called up record company executives and stirred up a competitive frenzy. Clive Davis, the president of Columbia, and Ahmet Erdogan, the head of Atlantic, were there to go monster to monster. Godzilla versus Mothra. They all came, so we knew that however well we did, there was going to be some serious bidding. And there was. I told a couple of jokes, introduced the band, made the audience laugh, and we played our set. I couldn't hear my voice, no monitors, so I had to scream out, "You got the love," over the din of the band. But I'd learned how to do that by playing the clubs in New York all those years. There was Clive Davis, clapping enthusiastically after every song. We'd unfortunately run through all our numbers when he shouted, "Encore!" We finished the set and ran off stage. Frank came running backstage. "Get back up there and play something," he said. And I said, "But we don't know anything else." And he said, "Just do a jam." And I said, "Okay, we'll do a thing called Wits Tip," which was a jam we do every night at the end of a set, something I could get cute with. "We're Aerosmith, ladies and genitals. We'll be back in 15 minutes. And don't forget to try the beef dips." Frank goes, "Just tell him the name of the song is We Don't Want to Fuck You, Lady. We Just Want to Eat Your Sandwiches." The room roared, and the band played hot. I made up the lyrics as I went along. Clive Davis lost it. He just lost it. After the gig, he came backstage and said, "You guys were great. You're going to make it big. And you, son," he said, putting his arm around me and looking me straight in the eye, "are going to be the biggest star in America." And then I lost it. Clive inspired me to write the lyrics to No Surprise. 1971, we all heard the starter's gun. New York was such a pity, but at Max's Kansas City we won. We all shot the shit at the bar with Johnny O'Toole and his scar. And then old Clive Davis said he's surely gonna make us a star, just the way you are. But with all our style, I could see in his eye that we were going on trial. It was no surprise. Aerosmith got signed to Columbia Records in 1972 by Clive Davis for $125,000. We stayed up all night celebrating, but we knew that just getting a record contract wasn't the be-all and end-all of our career. When we finally woke up and saw what was in it, the smell didn't seem so sweet. The contract said we had to deliver 2 albums a year, which would be impossible on account of the fact we were out on the road touring nonstop, fast and furious, to support the singles the radio stations were playing. That's the way you did it. Frank Connolly was smart enough and rich enough to know that the band needed to go off by itself and write without the women around. And he obliged me. The motherfucker knew. He knew. If Joe and I could write songs, we would take the group to a whole other level. And to do that, we needed to live in a house together, rent a place for 2 weeks. Let's go. First he put us into the Sheraton Manchester, north of Boston, and then in a couple of suites at the Hilton near the airport, where I wrote the lyrics to Dream On, and then in a house in Foxborough, where we lived the week before recording the first album. I'd wake up in the morning and say, "Tom, let's go and see if we can play this song." I'd play a few bars of Dream On the piano and say, "Well, what if Tom plays these notes?" I sang them, he played them, and it was fucking perfect. Perfect. That's where Dream On started to come together. The other guys followed my piano. I said, Joe, you play what my right hand's doing. Brad, you play the left hand. When we did that, hello synchronicity. So the band did go out to Foxborough alone, but there are exceptions to every rule. Joey brought a girl, his girlfriend, and one night says to me, she wants to do you, and you can have her. And that